The Roots of the Reformation, by Cal Adam. I. Weaknesses in the Church. Rome. Modern historians are agreed that the roots of the Reformation reach far back into the High Middle Ages. The former monk of Cluny, Gregory VII, in his zeal for the liberty and reform of the Church, so interpreted the papal claims formulated by Augustine, Gregory the Great and Nicholas I, that right up into the late Middle Ages they excited repeated resistance from the secular powers, shook the prestige of the papal see and so prepared the way for Luther's Reformation. Gregory's Dictatus Papi, in which he claimed for the Pope a direct authority even over secular affairs, with the right to depose unworthy princes and release their subjects from their oath of allegiance, inspired papal policy all through the Middle Ages. This certainly added a corrosive bitterness and a devastating violence, a violence which did not stop short of the papal see itself, to the conflicts which in any event would have been bitter enough between regnum and sacerdotium, the struggle between the Emperor Henry IV and the Pope over investitures, the battles with the Hohenstaufen, Frederick Barbarossa and Frederick II, the conflicts with Philip the Fair of France and Ludwig of Bavaria. In Frederick II's Manifesto of 1230, Gregory IX is already branded as the great dragon and antichrist of the last days. In 1301, Philip the Fair had Boniface's bull Osculta publicly burned, and in 1303 had the Pope himself taken into custody as a heretic, blasphemer and simoniac. Ludwig of Bavaria, supported by the Franciscan spirituals, declared Pope John XXII a formal heretic in the Reichstag at Nuremberg in 1323. The counterattack of the spiritual sword was a series of excommunications, extending to the fourth degree of kindred, and years of interdict over whole countries. Germany alone was under interdict for 20 years, which meant that no public religious service could be held, no sacrament could be publicly administered, no bell could sound. The more often these ecclesiastical penalties were imposed, the blunter grew the spiritual sword. Inevitably, the religion and morality of the people suffered serious damage, their sense of the Church was weakened, their sympathies were alienated from Christ's vicar. In due course there arose theologians amongst the Franciscan spirituals, particularly their general Michael of Cesena, and William of Ockham, who in numerous writings questioned the founding by Christ of the papacy as the Church knows it. And Marsilius of Padua in 1324 drew up a revolutionary program entitled Defensa Pace, with a theory of Church and State which broke completely with existing ecclesiastical constitutions, a significant prelude to the Reformation. 1. Anti-papal feeling in Germany gained ground when, in 1314, the See of Rome moved to Avignon and was thus brought completely under French influence, and again when the financial burdens arising out of the double establishment at Rome and Avignon compelled the Pope to build up a system of taxation which, when expanded, weighed heavily both on spiritual and on economic life. The Camera Apostolica covered the whole Church with a net of taxation called the census. Besides the revenues of the papal state, this included pay money, the tax paid by newly appointed archbishops, bishops and abbots, spolia, the total assets of deceased prelates, the numerous administrative taxes and procurations for papal visitations, above all, the taxes on the revenues of vacant benefices, and annats payment of the first year's income, or at least half of it, from all ecclesiastical appointments made by the Pope. Since Clement IV had claimed for the Pope unlimited authority over all ecclesiastical appointments in Christendom, the number of benefices reserved to the Pope had risen beyond computation. This aroused general opposition, especially when John XXII, in the course of his conflict with Ludwig of Bavaria, tried to fill all the vacant sees and offices in Germany with his own supporters. In a similar spirit, but contrary to prevailing ecclesiastical law, the papal chancellery in the 14th and 15th centuries encouraged cumulus beneficiorum, i.e., the holding of many benefices by one person, and commendation, by which a benefice could be conferred simply for the income derived from it, without the holders having any spiritual obligations to fulfill. Moreover, the Pope could promise to provide a person to a benefice even before its present occupant had actually died. The spirit of Mammon had won such an ascendancy in the Curia that Pope Clement VII, for example, at the very height of the Reformation storm, was trying to make money from the sale of cardinals' hats. It is against this background that we must understand the denunciation of the great Catholic preacher Guillaume von Keysersperg. It is no longer the Holy Ghost who appoints the rulers of the Church, but the devil, and for money, for favor and by bribery of the cardinals. 2. It is easily understandable that the Curia's irresponsible policies in matters of taxation and appointments, together with the arbitrary occupation of ecclesiastical offices in Germany by foreigners, gravely limited orderly diocesan government, and that they aroused on all sides uncertainty in regard to the law and consequent discontent amounting to unrest and resistance. There were expensive lawsuits that had to be taken to the highest papal court, the Roman Rota. The German nation had its public grievances Gravamen and Nationis Germanici. They were raised for the first time in 1456 by Archbishop Dietrich of Mainz at the Fürstentag at Frankfurt. From then on they came up again and again in the Reichstag in the form in which the humanist Jacob Wimpfeling had consolidated them. But the abuses, so far from being removed, mounted from year to year as the papal requirements increased. The Pope's yearly income was greater than that of any German emperor. John 22, for instance, died leaving 750,000 gold coins in his treasury, a figure so high, considering the values and conditions of the time, that it was bound to have a catastrophic effect on the believer when he pictured against this background the poor tent maker Paul, or the still poorer fisherman Peter, coming with dusty sandals to Rome and bringing nothing with them but a deep and noble desire to preach Christ and to die for Christ. If the fiscal policy of Avignon, where the popes had their court for 65 years, seriously damaged the political and economic interests of German Christianity and so at least indirectly undermined the religious authority of the Pope, the Great Schism of the West, from 1378 to 1417, threatened the prestige of the papacy with final extinction. In opposition to Urban VI, elected under pressure from the Roman people and disliked for various reasons, the French cardinals in Avignon, the so-called Ultramontani, declaring the election unfree and invalid, raised a cousin of the French king to the papal chair as Clement VII, and Christendom was split into two camps. The division went right through the Christian body. Whole orders, such as the Cistercians, Carthusians, Franciscans, Dominicans and Carmelites, fell into two halves, and since both popes excommunicated each other and each other's supporters, the whole of Christendom was at least nominally excommunicated. The split did not come to an end with the deaths of the two popes, for the cardinals in Rome and Avignon all obstinately held their own papal elections. Matters grew worse when the Council of Pisa, in 1409, deposed both the Rome and the Avignon popes as notorious schismatics and heretics and elected a third, Alexander V, who soon died, and was followed by John 23. Since both the deposed popes obstinately maintained the validity of their elections, this led, not to unity, but from wicked duality to accursed triplicity. It was only in 1417, with the election of Martin V at the Council of Constance, that the Church could acknowledge own single head again in place of the three previously elected claimants. It was inevitable that this schism of nearly 40 years should shake the Church to her foundation, that radicals of the type of William of Ockham and Marsilius of Padua should formulate a democratic theory of the Church, taking the plenitude of ecclesiastical authority to rest in the body of the faithful, not in a single head. That thoughtful theologians such as Peter Daly and the distinguished John Gerson should construct the so-called conciliar theory, making the Pope subordinate to a general council and giving the Church a parliamentary instead of a monarchical constitution. The idea of the Church received from the Fathers, in which there was but one rock, one keeper of the keys, one shepherd, began to weaken. Trust in the Father of Christendom was gone. In this sense, the experience of the Great Schism had impressed its decisive stamp on the minds of the faithful lords. Hard upon the dogmatic attack on papal authority inevitably conjured up by the Great Western Schism, there followed its moral collapse, the Renaissance popes seem to have carried out in their own lives that cult of idolatrous humanism, demonic ambition and unrestrained sensuality which was in many ways bound up with the reawakening of the ancient ideal of manhood. The most sober ecclesiastical historians agree that the reigns of the popes from Sixtus IV to Leo X represent, from the religious and ecclesiastical point of view, the lowest level of the papacy since the 10th and 11th centuries by Elmire, Volume 2, p. 477. The unbridled nepotism of Sixtus IV, which threatened to degrade the papacy to a dynastic heritage and the patrimonium petri to a petty Italian state lords, Volume I, p. 75, was followed by the fateful bull against which is issued by Innocent VIII, a man of scandalous life. Worse still was the conduct of Alexander VI, stained with murder and impurity, and the demonic lust for blood and power of his son Cesare Borgia. Then came the burning of the Dominican Savonarola at Alexander's orders, the sheer political jugglery of Julius II, whose pontificate was dissipated in campaigns and wars, and finally the pleasure-loving worldliness of Leo X, who found the chase and the theatre more important than Martin Luther and his religious aspirations. The reputation of the papacy was dragged not merely in the dust but in the mud. It is especially significant of the mentality of Leo X and of the Renaissance popes in general, that in the solemn procession at his enthronement in the papal chair, the Most Blessed Sacrament was accompanied by statues of naked pagan gods, with the inscription "First Venus reigned the age of Alexander VI, then Mars in the time of Julius II. And now under Leo X Pallas Athena holds the scepter lords," Volume I, p. 86. The news of these scandalous doings, of course, soon crossed the Alps and stripped the last vestige of credit from the mother of Christendom. The humanist circles at Erfurt and Florence took care of that, and so later did Ulrich von Hutten and the Dunkelmaner letters. Nor was Luther himself far behind them. Even when he was translating the Bible in 1522, before he had reached the heyday of his hatred for Rome, he depicted the great harlot of the Apocalypse as wearing the triple papal crown. Germany. Let us turn now from the crying scandals surrounding the highest ecclesiastical authority to the abuses which marred the German Church and her spiritual life before Luther's advent. It is certainly not true to say that the German Church which witnessed these scandals in the Roman government was herself ripe for destruction. The constant urge for reform and the tremendous response when Luther raised the alarm would be incomprehensible if Christian life had died out completely. We can even assert that German Christianity in the last phase of the Middle Ages was, in spite of all, more devout than it is today. For today a denunciation of abuses by a Martin Luther would cause no revolution. It was the age of the three Catharines, of Siena, Bologna and Genoa. The age when Saint Bridget scourged the abuses of the Avignon Curia with the flames of her wrath, when Thomas a Kempis wrote his immortal Imitation of Christ, when an unknown priest wrote the Theologia Germanica first published by Luther. It was the age in which German mysticism flowered in Eckhart, Tauler and Susso, and the Devotio Moderna of the Brothers of the Common Life was aspiring to revivify, spiritualize and personalize benumbed Christianity. The evidence grows greater and greater that even the common people of the Church, so long as they had not fallen a prey to sectarianism or been touched by radical humanism, were genuinely devoted to their Catholic faith despite all the abuses, and that daily life remained embedded in religious usage right up to the end of the Middle Ages. Even the simple people then knew how to distinguish between the office and the person's own piety and to apply our Lord's words to the gloomy contemporary scene, "All things therefore whatsoever they shall say to you, observe and do, but according to their works do ye not." Matt 23:3. During this same second half of the 15th century, there was an abundance of pious works ad rendium animi for the welfare of souls. New churches were built, new parishes opened, new appointments of preachers made and charitable institutions set up. New religious and charitable brotherhoods were formed, and even new devotions introduced, such as the Angelus and the Way of the Cross. There was more catechetical and devotional literature than ever. Booklets and examinations of conscience for confession, catechism tables, Bible story books, rhymed Bibles, poor men's Bibles, appeared in the service of religious instruction. Before 1518, a translation of the Bible into High German had run into 14 editions and one in Low German into 4 editions. All in all, one can fairly speak of an increase of piety in this period. Yet it was seriously lacking in the inner spirit, in the living penetration of pious practices with the spirit of the gospel. There was too much externalism, too much mere automatism and superficiality, and also far too much unhealthy emotionalism in this piety. The shepherds and teachers who might have directed and deepened the stream of faith were lacking. The higher clergy were mostly noblemen who had entered the priesthood from material rather than spiritual motives. Bishoprics, prelacies and abbacies had for long been the preserve of the nobility. At the outbreak of the Reformation, 18 bishoprics and archbishoprics in Germany were occupied by the sons of princes. Proof of proficiency in the tuni was an absolutely requisite qualification for most canonries. It is evident that prelates so immersed in worldliness and pleasure had neither the ability nor the desire to break the bread of life to the people. Over against these prelates, God's junkers, we see the lower clergy. They seldom had benefices of their own and were compelled either to carry out the duties of a benefice for a pittance from some member of the higher clergy, or earn their living by helping to serve mass and doing odd jobs about the church. Their economic position was therefore extremely precarious. Their theological training was no better. Excepting the handful of the clergy who were educated at the universities, most of them contented themselves with a modest smattering of religion, Latin and liturgy. Their morals were not much better than their theological knowledge. One could hardly expect a higher moral standard from them than the example set by their superiors. Documentary evidence indicates that there was amongst them much brutality, drunkenness, gambling, avarice, simony and superstition. To secure a living for themselves, they exacted almost insupportable fees for the slightest exercise of their priesthood, even from the poor and destitute. The charge for the administration of the last sacraments was so high that extreme unction was called the sacrament of the rich. Concubinage was so general that at the councils of Constance and Basel, the Emperor Sigismund proposed the abolition of the law of celibacy. Amidst the general decline, there were still, of course, plenty of morally upright priests. The humanist Jacob Wimpfeling, a severely critical observer of the life of the Church, vouched before God to knowing in the 6 dioceses of the Rhine many, nay innumerable, chaste and learned prelates and clergy, of unblemished reputation, full of piety, liberality and care for the poor lords, volume I. P. 90. We need only call to mind the illustrious figure of the saintly Nicholas of Cusa, the herald of the modern age and tireless reformer, who sought over and over again by visitations, by word of mouth, and in his writings, to communicate his own spirit of piety to the German Church. But to most of the clergy we must apply the words of Pope Adrian VI in his first consistorial address, quoting from Saint Bernard: "Vice has grown so much a matter of course that those who are stained with it are no longer aware of the stink of sin." The regular clergy were no better than the seculars. Here too we must, of course, beware of false generalizations. It was precisely in this second half of the 15th century that almost all the older orders made an effort to reform. In the case of the Benedictines, there were, for example, the reforms of Kastel, Melk and Bursfeld. All the mendicant orders still had houses in which the original lofty spirit of the love of God and neighbor was alive. And again a saint would arise somewhere in the church, like Bernardino of Siena, John Gaperstrand the lover of souls, and the noble Caritas Perkheimer, who were shining examples of Christian piety. Luther's account of his own experiences in the Augustinian priory at Erfurt gives the light to the statement that monastic discipline was in a universal decline. It is also significant that later on it was ex-monks in particular who were among Luther's best cooperators, who were among the most impatient, in fact, of current abuses. Nevertheless, We have from within the church enough official and unofficial testimony to give us a gloomy picture of life in the orders. Amongst the more ancient orders, only the Carthusians and in part the Cistercians really maintained their original standard. In the other monasteries there was a tragic decline in discipline. The great Benedictine abbeys had become a mere convenience of the nobility. But in the mendicant orders, too, the foundations of the religious life had begun to totter, not least on account of the irresponsible caprice with which the officials of the Curia at Avignon dispensed religious from the existing rules of the order or abolished them altogether. Monks and nuns outside the cloister were already a familiar sight in the 15th century, and in the 16th the begging friars obtained general permission from Rome to live outside their priories. Community life, and especially community prayer, fell into disuse. So did voluntary poverty. Many of the monks retained their inherited estates and bought or inherited their own cells in the monastery. Erasmus of Rotterdam in his Enchiridion singles out for blame their lovelessness and their avarice. Other moral transgressions must be added. The Beguines, for instance, had won for themselves the nickname of the Friars' Celeresses. The sister of Duke Magnus was known among the rich clares of Ribnitz as Impudicissima Atissa. It is not to be wondered at that the shaven heads, as the monks were called, were despised and hated by the people, all the more because they were patently increasing in numbers. Together with the lower clergy and the wandering scholars, the stormy petrels of the revolution, they formed a clerical proletariat. Johannes Agricola estimated the total number of clergy and religious in Germany at the time in a small total population at 1,400,000 lords, volume I, p. 86. It cannot be doubted that the majority of this clerical proletariat had neither the intellectual nor the moral capacity to so much as guess the profundity of the questions raised by Luther, let alone fully to realize the gravity of the challenge and to counter it with an adequate response. Omnium clero, every evil comes from the clergy. As early as 1245 at the Council of Lyon, Pope Innocent IV had called the sins of the higher and lower clergy one of the five wounds in the body of the Church. And at the Second Council of Lyon in 1274 Gregory X declared that the wickedness of many prelates was the cause of the ruin of the whole world. Cf. Bielmeier, volume 2, p. 336. Machiavelli, again, speaks volumes in the sarcastic remark that we Italians may thank the Church and our priests that we have become irreligious and wicked lords, volume I, p. 119. In this waste of clerical corruption it was impossible for the Spirit of our Lord to penetrate into the people, take root there and bring true religion to flower. Since there was at this time no catechism of infants, the sermons on Sundays and feast days were the chief sources from which the laity drew their religious education, and these sources were often choked up. Since at this time, moreover, as during the whole of the Middle Ages, communion was very infrequent outside the ranks of the mystics, there was no sacramental impulse towards an interiorizing and deepening of religion, so the attention of the faithful was directed towards externals. Religion was materialized. Pious interest was focused more on the holy things, relics, than on the sacraments, more on pilgrimages and flagellations than on attending the services of the Church, and most of all on indulgences. The cult of relics and indulgences had grown to gigantic proportions since Leo X had attached indulgences of 1,000, 10,000 and 100,000 years to the veneration of relics. Erasmus criticized this kind of piety in the bitter words, "We kiss the shoes of the saints and their dirty kerchiefs while we leave their writings, their holiest and truest relics, to lie on red lords," volume I, p. 108. Frederick the Wise, the famous protector of Luther, had built up his treasury of relics in the castle church at Wittenberg to 18,885 fragments. Anyone who believed in and venerated them could gain indulgences amounting to 2 million years. When Boniface IX made of ecclesiastical indulgences what looked like a commercial traffic, even secular princes and cities became eager to take part in the distribution of them, so as to assure for themselves a generous share of the inflowing money. 3. From the middle of the 15th century, the popes began to distribute indulgences for the dead. The Legate Parodi, in connection with an indulgence granted by Pope Sixtus IV to Louis XI for the whole of France, announces that the indulgence could be made certainly effective for any soul in purgatory, even if the person gaining it were in a state of mortal sin, so long as the indulgenced work i.e. money payment were performed. Pope Sixtus IV did indeed correct his legate's declaration to the extent of saying that the application of the indulgence to the dead could only be a matter of petition, not of certainty. But Parodi's other statement that the indulgence could be gained for the dead by people living in mortal sin was never censured. In the prevailing low state of clerical education, preachers of the indulgence, such as the Dominican Tetzel for instance, eagerly seized on Parodi's pronouncement, so that many preachers really did adopt as their favorite tag, "Your cash no sooner clinks in the bowl than out of purgatory jumps the soul." Some of the papal decrees themselves were in great measure responsible for this crude interpretation of indulgences. They employed a misleading formula current from the 13th century onwards, which spoke of a remissio pena et culpa, remission of pain and guilt, or even of a remissio peccatorum, remission of sins. For whereas an indulgence is not concerned with the forgiveness of the guilt of sin, nor with the remission of eternal punishment, but only with the remission of temporal punishment, that is, a mitigation or shortening of that penitential suffering which the sinner must undergo either here or in purgatory, it is unnecessary to emphasize how much this hideous simoniacal abuse of indulgences corrupted true piety, and how indulgences were perverted to a blasphemous haggling with God. Night fell on the German church, a night that grew ever deeper and darker as other abuses attached themselves to the excessive cult of relics and the practice of indulgences. The latter was encouraged by the current mass pilgrimages, which were positively epidemic. Associated with them, especially at the time of the Great Schism, was the movement of the flagellants, in which pilgrimage was combined with public self-scourging. Though condemned alike by Pope Clement VI and the Council of Constance, they constantly reasserted themselves, uprooted the faithful from their proper situation in parochial and domestic life, and threw them into a state of hysterical excess and unhealthy mysticism. Behind all these excesses was the driving power of rampant superstition. Allying itself with religion, it had taken possession of the broad mass of the people. It is probably true to say that this superstition had made itself even more at home in the German soul than elsewhere, and developed, even amongst educated people, a vast obsession with the devil. It was a lingering heritage from Germanic and Roman paganism. Since the Inquisition's campaign against the Catharists, who had acknowledged evil as a first principle, this devil obsession had begun to ruin daily living and social intercourse. In particular, there was a totally uncritical acceptance of every kind of improbable horror charged against witches. The witch trials and witch burnings went on by inquisitors, secular governments, the reformers. Luther himself taught that witches must be destroyed, and the official church did not shield the victims of these atrocities with the bulwark of clear gospel teaching. On the contrary, Innocent VIII, in his bull Summis Desiderans 1484, gave the Dominicans in Constance plenary powers in the matter of witch burning, and threatened with ecclesiastical punishments anyone who opposed the prosecution of witches. He thus did all that the highest ecclesiastical authority could do to encourage and legalize the obsession. Christ had healed those possessed by devils, but now, in the name of the same Christ, they were to be burned. It was night indeed in a great part of Christendom. Such is the conclusion of our survey of the end of the 15th century. Amongst the common people, a fearful decline of true piety into religious materialism and morbid hysteria. Amongst the clergy, both lower and higher, widespread worldliness and neglect of duty, and amongst the very shepherds of the church, demonic ambition and sacrilegious perversion of holy things. Both clergy and people must crime culpa, maxima culpa. Yes, it was night. Had Martin Luther then arisen with his marvelous gifts of mind and heart, his warm penetration of the essence of Christianity, his passionate defiance of all unholiness and ungodliness, the elemental fury of his religious experience, his surging, soul-shattering power of speech, and not least that heroism in the face of death with which he defied the powers of this world. Had he brought all these magnificent qualities to the removal of the abuses of the time and the cleansing of God's garden from weeds, had he remained a faithful member of his church, humble and simple, sincere and pure, then indeed we should today be his grateful debtors. He would be forever our great reformer, our true man of God, our teacher and leader, comparable to Thomas Aquinas and Francis of Assisi. He would have been the greatest saint of the German people, the refounder of the church in Germany, a second Boniface. Dash. But and here lies the tragedy of the Reformation and of German Christianity. He let the warring spirits drive him to overthrow not merely the abuses in the church, but the church herself, founded upon Peter, bearing through the centuries the Successio Apostolica. He let them drive him to commit what Saint Augustine calls the greatest sin with which a Christian can burden himself. He set up altar against altar and tore in pieces the one body of Christ. How did this come about, and must we continue forever to join in that lament of contemporary Christendom which Saint Augustine sounded in his work against the Donatists, Ego lacera valda cruelly am I torn? These are questions which I shall seek to answer. Dash.